Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bob Borisov of the Campaign for America's Future, who examines the corporate giveaways included in an economic stimulus package recently passed by the U.S. House of Representatives. Ken Good of the Center for National Security Studies, who discusses the unknown status of over 1,000 people detained by the U.S. Department of Justice in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, and a report on the arrest of 18 anti-war protesters at an October 25th peace demonstration in Hartford, Connecticut. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks, frightened immigrant day laborers started calling up the Workplace Project on Long Island with complaints of harassment. In many cases, Latino immigrants were mistaken for Muslims because of their dark skin. With edgy suburban New Yorkers and increased security, Latino day laborers, mostly young adults from Ecuador, El Salvador, and Mexico, are feeling the heat. According to the news magazine In These Times, some workers are so scared they are afraid to leave their homes. Just weeks before the terrorist attacks, there was a big push for immigration reform as U.S. President George W. Bush and Mexican President Vicente Fox were working on an agreement to legalize some of the 8 million undocumented immigrants working in the United States. Now, immigration has taken a back seat to fighting the war on terrorism and beefing up homeland security that looks at foreigners with suspicion. In addition, anti-immigrant groups, led by the Federation for American Immigration Reform, are blasting what they call advocates for open borders for undermining the war on terrorists. Meanwhile, pro-reform groups like the National Immigration Forum are clearly on the defensive. They are reluctant to criticize President Bush's push for new police powers, including authority to hold immigrants for 7 days without having to file criminal charges. The war on terrorism will likely handicap efforts to reform restrictive immigration laws for years to come. Mother Jones magazine reports that anti-abortion activists have come up with a stealth strategy to harass family planning clinics. They're pushing states to impose costly layers of regulation on abortion clinics, all in the name of protecting women's health. In Louisiana, a hotbed of anti-abortion legislation, the state now requires that all abortion clinics meet tough building codes that mandate things such as the width of hallways and the shape of water fountains. In other states, from Utah to Connecticut, anti-choice activists are working to pass targeted regulation of abortion provider bills. These laws were first passed in the mid-90s in several southern states and dictate building codes on ceiling heights, counseling room dimensions, air circulation rates, and separate changing rooms for men. Robin Rothrock, director of the Hope Medical Group for Women in Shreveport, Louisiana, has survived militant protests and chemical attacks from anti-abortion groups. Now, she says, the added red tape is one anti-choice strategy that is working. "We're an outpost under siege," Rothrock told Mother Jones. "The most overwhelming part comes from the realization that you have the entire state government trying to shut you down." David Grimes, former staffer at the Centers for Disease Control, dismisses the need for more regulation of abortion clinics. An expert on abortion safety, Grimes states, "Here we have an urgent response in the absence of a problem. It is science run amok. It's public health run backwards." Sierra magazine reports that free trade is crushing Mexico's long tradition of cultivating native corn. For generations, Mexican Indians have grown unique varieties of corn, including exotic blue corn with seed stock that dates back 3 or 4 generations. That tradition is now being threatened by the influx of genetically altered corn from the United States, which contains the toxin BT, courtesy of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, which took effect in 1994. Since 1999, Mexico imported 5.5 tons of corn, nearly triple the amount from when NAFTA took effect. Few people know exactly how much gene-altered corn is being imported into Mexico because, like the U.S., Mexico has no labeling law for disclosing biotech foods. To alert consumers, Greenpeace activists wearing contamination suits now regularly crash Mexico City food markets to point out the biotech ingredients that are now put into foods as varied as Cocoa Krispies and Coca-Cola. The invasion of genetically altered corn may damage Mexico's 6,000-year tradition of indigenous agriculture. There is strong evidence that new biotech seeds are cross-pollinating with native corn, forever changing the unique varieties adapted to Mexico's climate. Now it turns out that Mexican migrants are bringing back gene-altered corn seeds to Mexico's Corn Belt when they return from the United States. They believe they are carrying miracle seeds. However, they may actually be the seeds of destruction for Mexico's native corn culture, developed by American-based food and chemical corporations. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
With the highest unemployment rate in a decade, a falling stock market, and consumer confidence in decline, the U.S. economy is headed for a deep recession. The terrorist attacks of September 11th aggravated an already shaky economy and motivated both the White House and Congress to propose economic stimulus packages. But a bill recently passed by the House of Representatives has been widely criticized for what many observers say is an unprecedented tax giveaway to the nation's wealthiest corporations, while virtually ignoring the plight of laid-off workers. The legislation, which narrowly passed the House, repeals the alternative minimum tax and makes the repeal retroactive for 15 years. If signed into law, the nation's largest companies would reap substantial rewards. IBM would get $1.4 billion, General Motors $833 million, and General Electric would gain $671 million. The Senate will soon consider their own economic stimulus package. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bob Borisage, co-director with the Campaign for America's Future, who critically examines the corporate giveaways included in the House bill, which his group has characterized as profiteering in the name of patriotism.
The stimulus has really become the refuge for all scoundrels in Washington. As you know, the economy is in very bad shape. It was probably in a recession before September 11th. And since September 11th, layoffs have been cascading across the country. Last month, we had the largest increase in unemployment in 21 years in a single month. And most observers think we were in a recession before September, and it's now going to go very deep, very fast, and may last a long time. So in these circumstances, government has to act to get the economy going, to put money in the hands of people who will spend it and start to create some demand that will get companies once again hiring people and investing and starting to produce. Both parties really agree with that. But what's happened is, under the cover of Afghanistan and anthrax, which is 24 hours all the time, 7 days a week on the media, the special interests in Washington, the great corporations and their lobbies, plus the finance contributors, have combined with conservatives in the House and in the Senate to pass in the name of stimulus what can only be called a disgrace, a combination of war profiteering by the corporations, massive tax cuts that will have very little stimulus value, and then upper income tax breaks basically for the contributors that are the base of the Republican Party. And the amount of abuse is really disgraceful. And I must say, if we weren't in the war, if it hadn't been September 11th, if we weren't so distracted by Afghanistan and anthrax, I don't believe that these people would have dared to try to do this. What you had coming out of the House, for example, is a bill that repeals permanently, in the name of a temporary stimulus to the economy, permanently repeals the minimum tax on corporations. Now, that's the tax that ensures that no matter how clever their lobbyists and accountants are, corporations have to pay something every year in income tax if they're profitable. So not only do they repeal that permanently in the future, but they repeal it 15 years retroactively, so that companies like IBM in January would get a check of $1.4 billion from the federal government in a rebate for loopholes that they couldn't take advantage of over the last 15 years. GM would get about $830, General Electric about $671 million, and most of the money after that goes to oil and and gas companies, probably not surprisingly, disproportionately located in Texas. This is just a scoundrel's bill that passed out of the House on an almost pure party line vote. And it's now pending before the Senate, and the senators are now starting to negotiate on it. One other piece about the bill that's sort of stunning, it used to be when the economy got bad, one of the counter-cyclical devices we had, one of the things that automatically pumped money into the economy was unemployment insurance. Well, now the way our workforce has changed and the way states have cut back unemployment insurance, only about 40% of the workers that are being laid off are eligible for unemployment. So one of the demands that's been made is let's make sure we extend unemployment insurance to everyone who's being laid off. Let's extend the number of weeks so that they have time to find a job. And let's increase the minimum benefit, or the average benefit, so that it can support their families a little better. And let's give them some special help to sustain health care for their families. The Republican bills essentially stiff all these demands and instead do over $100 billion in tax cuts for the large corporations and upper-income taxpayers. This used to be a bipartisan position. This didn't used to be a controversial thing that in a time of recession, one of the first things you do is make sure the unemployment system works. But in this case, I think, again, because the country's so distracted, the scoundrels are at the trough.
What is the Democratic Party likely to do here, given that we are in a crisis environment, the post-September 11th environment, where the Bush administration has very high approval ratings? There's a real desire in the country for unity and not division. With so much at stake here and these billions, hundreds of billions of dollars going to the wealthiest sector of the nation, what are the Democrats likely to do? Are they going to appeal to public opinion here, or are they going to cave in?
Well, I think this is a case where the public has to weigh in as opposed to the politicians leading. This is a case where if this continues to operate under the radar screen and people just don't pay attention to what's happening and don't express their outrage, then I think the president is likely to get much of what he wants, and Democrats will negotiate a peace but not be able to lessen this outrage, and they will generally cave in. There is great trepidation, great fear on the Democratic leadership about taking on the president frontally, even though this stimulus program has shaken them from their stupor because it is so outrageous and so indefensible that they've started to at least object to it and to try to put forth an alternative. So the key here is whether people will call their senators and let them know they would simply be outraged if this turns into a giveaway to large corporations and upper-income taxpayers. But we're trying to just wake people up so that and break through some of this kind of news blackout or blanket, which is Afghanistan and anthrax, so that they look at what these people are trying to do under that kind of air cover. Because if people look at it, I assure you, if they pay any attention at all and look at what's in it, they will be totally outraged. And if they will register their outrage, we can stop it. But that will only happen if it comes from the bottom up. It won't happen out of Washington.
That was Bob Borisage, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Contact the campaign by calling area code 202-955-5665. Or visit their website at www.ourfuture.org. With the USA Patriot Act passed by Congress and signed into law by President Bush on October 26th, federal law enforcement agencies now have expanded power to monitor and investigate individuals they suspect may be connected with terrorist groups. These new powers include roving telephone wiretaps, internet surveillance, and secret or sneak-and-peek searches of suspects' homes and offices. Of great concern to many civil liberties advocates around the country is the fact that these new powers are subject to reduced judicial oversight. But equally alarming to civil liberties groups is the ongoing detention of more than 1,000 immigrants who are rounded up by the U.S. Department of Justice in the days following the September 11th terror attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C. Little or no information about who is being held, why, and their location has been made public, with many family members unaware of how to contact their relatives in custody. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ken Goode, a policy analyst with the Center for National Security Studies, who discusses the status of the detainees. The center is part of a coalition of groups which have demanded information from the government on the detainees under the Freedom of Information Act.
We've been hearing press reports from as far back as early October about specific cases, but there really is no general information that has been disseminated, and that's why that our organization and 20 other groups signed on to a Freedom of Information Act request where we petitioned the Department of Justice, the FBI, and the INS for that very basic information, the names of the individuals who've been arrested or detained, the charges against them, where they're being held, and so we hope to get that information. Now, this weekend, we heard some reports that the actual number, which I believe is now up to 1,147, is nowhere near that high. And the Justice Department has been kind of pulling together every available person that they could possibly put on that list to make the impression that they're doing a great deal of detention. Now, we are a little confused by this and why the Justice Department would want to inflate that number for anything other than propaganda reasons, and that is very troubling. Regardless of whether or not there are 1,100, 800, 500, we need to know exactly how many people there are, who they are, and what charges were brought against them.
Now, is what the Justice Department doing in terms of withholding this information about who the detainees are and why they're being held and where they are, is that legal under current law, or is that something that's sort of extrajudicial?
Well, it's our position that there's a constitutional and common law right to know who has been arrested. We kind of paint the picture of, imagine going into your local county courthouse or police station, and you local reporters or anyone would be able to view the arrest docket. And that's really all we're trying to find out. In a very small number of cases and for a very short period of time, it could be reasonable to argue that you need to keep some of this information secret, but not on the massive level and scale of having 1,000 people detained without any information released to the public, and in some cases not even to their own families.
Should it make any difference that these people are not U.S. citizens and that can be a justification in the minds of the Justice Department for withholding this information? Or are there laws in the books that mandate this information be given to the public?
Well, certainly if they're in the United States, the Constitution applies to you, and certainly the laws and regulations of the United States apply to the actions of the Justice Department, whether it's on non-citizens or U.S. citizens, and we feel it should apply equally, and certainly in this case.
Now, the Freedom of Information inquiry that you made about these individuals, what are the groups that have joined you in that?
Oh, well, there's now about 40 organizations. We received a great deal of support after the announcement last Monday, and we have groups from the American Civil Liberties Union, the Amnesty International USA, the World Association Against Torture, Human Rights Watch, just a very large list of organizations that have signed on, and we're very grateful for their support. And we feel that signifies exactly what the level of interest there is in this country about this case.
And what's the timeline for getting some kind of conclusion to that FOIA request?
Well, actually, we did receive some good news from the Justice Department in that they agreed to expedite our request, meaning that they would handle it sooner rather than later. Now, there's no real time limit based on given in that case, but we hope that will mean that we will at least have an answer in the relative near future, I'd say in a matter of a few weeks.
What's the interest level about these 1,000 or more detainees from human rights groups across the world? Of course, the United States and many international human rights groups do intervene or try to intervene when there are individuals held in a similar manner in other countries, you know, people, American citizens, for instance, who may be held in another country without any of the kind of normal releases of information about, you know, who's being held and why they're being held and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've also heard that a lot of the foreign consulates are getting involved because of the lack of information given out by the government. They aren't even notifying if a person is a foreign national, is they're arrested. It is required that the government notify the local consul or some government official from that country, and that has certainly not been done in this case either. So a lot of and it's mostly Middle Eastern countries that we're talking about here. We've had some contact from organizations around the world looking to support us. But again, without any hard information, it is very difficult for organizations and groups to make any kind of case.
Now, one man, a Pakistani national who was rounded up in this sweep after the September 11th attacks, his name is Mohammed Rafiq Butt. He was in INS custody and died while he was in custody, reportedly from natural causes. What kind of alarm bells does this ring with you in your office about the potential for abuse here, or just the sort of the human factor here that's being overlooked?
Well, certainly, and that is a tragedy, and it is unfortunate that he passed away in custody. I think it would be a stretch to say that there was any causation there. But it brings to light the fact that I believe his case was a relatively minor immigration violation, and he was detained well beyond what a normal case of that light would usually get. And the potential for abuse here is just enormous, considering the fact that we don't know what's going on in a vast number of these cases. And really, to reports credited to the government, very, very, very few of these people have anything to do with a terrorist investigation and are just kind of swept up in this national hysteria.
That was Ken Good, a policy analyst with the Center for National Security Studies. Contact the center by calling area code 202-944-7060 or visit their website at www.cnss.gwu.edu. Even before the U.S. began its bombing campaign against the Taliban government of Afghanistan, thousands of American citizens demonstrated against the prospect of a new war. Although much of the corporate media either ignored or denigrated those calling for a more peaceful method of bringing the perpetrators of the September 11th attacks to justice, protests have taken place in hundreds of cities and on university campuses around the country. On October 25th, students and other activists organized a peace protest in Connecticut's capital city of Hartford. But when more than 200 demonstrators attempted to march from Bushnell Park to the office of U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman in rush hour traffic, police moved in using pepper spray and clubs to break up the crowd. One demonstrator, a 60-year-old Vietnam veteran, was hospitalized for a broken rib after being tackled by police. 18 of those participating in the march were arrested on a range of serious charges and held overnight on $10,000 to $50,000 bond. A Green Party member of Hartford City Council has called for an investigation. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus was at the rally and has this report.
The event began with a rally in a park in downtown Hartford. Peace activist Chris Ducote, who has visited Iraq several times, said he's watched children die in their mother's arms due to the impacts of the U.S. embargo. He said that and other U.S. policies in the Middle East have enraged many of the people there.
So it's not out of the blue, and it's not because we love peace and freedom that the United States is creating much anger and resentment in the world. It's because we've been supporting oppression, we've been supporting terror, we've been supporting war.
The 200 demonstrators then set off en route to Senator Joe Lieberman's office to protest his vocal support for the war in Afghanistan. They took over the streets at rush hour without a permit. The crowd was mostly college students, but there were parents with young children and older people as well.
One, two, three, four. We will not support this war. Five, six, seven, eight. Act with justice, not with hate.
After several blocks, police brought in reinforcements and pushed demonstrators onto the sidewalk. A police spokesman said people were arrested for refusing to move out of the street. He said because police had no advance notice of the protest, they had not set up barricades and so used their squad cars to move people toward the sidewalk. Some of the protesters said police drove their squad cars right at them, actually bumping into one person. Wesleyan University student Jesse Duval described what happened next.
The police wanted us to move off of the sidewalk, and it's public property, and we're allowed to be on the sidewalk, and so I think there was a confrontation there. Sort of people asking police, why do we have to leave? And the police sort of took it violently and started arresting people and beating people.
One man was pepper sprayed and then beaten as he lay on the sidewalk, gasping for breath. No one reported seeing any violence coming from the protesters, and none of those arrested was charged with assault. Although the demonstration was organized through consensus meetings and had no formal leaders, witnesses said police pointed to people at the front of the march or those leading chants and grabbed them out of the crowd. 18 were arrested. Some bystanders criticized the demonstrators. A man waiting for a bus said,
I don't agree with it. These people here, the people that attack New York are not people that you can deal with. You can't compromise with these people that are idiots flying planes into the buildings. That's all they are. America's not the problem. It's these idiots that are hurting innocent people.
Others were sympathetic, both to the protesters' original message and to their treatment by police. One African-American woman told a group of friends,
"No, you need to know the truth about what's going on in the world, what these people are trying to do to people, not only in Afghanistan or anywhere else, even in your own community."
African-American activist and Green Party City Councilor Elizabeth Horton Sheff has requested a formal investigation by the city manager of what took place last Thursday. She said she's also looking into the matter herself.
I want to know what happened because, you know, I believe that people have the right to assemble under our Constitution. They have a right to free speech under our Constitution. And I'm also concerned about the heaviness of the charges. Some of the young people got charged, like, with inciting a riot. And I think the extra element that really ignited this is the fact that we're living in a climate where people want revenge for what happened in our country on September 11th. And I do believe that someone should be held accountable for what happened. I think we need to be careful as a nation how we do that.
All those arrested have been released on bails ranging from $10,000 to $50,000 on charges including disorderly conduct, interfering with police, and inciting to riot. Most have court appearances scheduled throughout the month of November. They are being represented by some of the best-known criminal defense lawyers in Connecticut. Several of those charged said they are contemplating filing civil charges against the Hartford Police Department. In Hartford, for Between the Lines, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
To contribute to the Hartford 18's Defense Fund, contact the Danbury Independent Media Center at 203-744-0763 or visit their website at www.madhattersimc.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie. Thank you.